It's Sunday, June 14th. We're looking at a morning where the lines between institutional stability and performative chaos are getting blurrier by the minute. Today, we're covering the lingering, unresolved questions from Seattle's autonomous zone aftermath, the new intellectual iron curtain being drawn around AI, and the harsh reality check that just hit the NBA. Here's the thing, the news cycle is moving fast, but the underlying structural issues aren't changing. Let's get into it. 6 years after the killing of 16-year-old Antonio Mays Jr. inside Seattle's Capitol Hill-occupied protest zone, the case remains unsolved. Documentation exists. Citizen journalists captured the event on video. But the investigation has effectively stalled. According to reports, the failure stems from a combination of a no-snitching culture among protesters and what the victim's father describes as a total breakdown in communication from the Seattle Police Department. When the police vacated the East Precinct, they left a vacuum that was filled by armed, untrained, and unaccountable security forces, creating an environment where violence was privatized and shielded by the very political ideology that claimed to oppose it. It's a sobering look at what happens when you replace established institutions with ad hoc ones that prioritize group preservation over truth. When you build an autonomous zone, you don't eliminate power, you just make it invisible and, frankly, untouchable. Moving to something that for once doesn't involve a total systemic collapse, the World Series of Birding. We're looking at a 24-hour marathon where teams of teenagers attempt to identify as many bird species as possible. It sounds like a niche hobby, but it's actually a masterclass in project management and high-stakes social development. These kids are using data-driven planning and real-time contingency management to navigate the competition, functioning less like casual birdwatchers and more like professional media producers. The integrity of the whole thing relies on an honor system. Every team member has to independently verify a sighting to get credit, which creates a pressure cooker for communication. It's a pretty compelling rebuttal to the idea that Gen Z is just sitting around in a state of social isolation. When you give people a genuinely difficult shared goal and throw in some intergenerational bonding with parents handling the logistics, you get results that look a lot more like maturity than alienation. Back in Washington, the Trump administration is leaning hard into short-term optics, even if it means piling up what looks like significant long-term debt. We're talking about a three-pronged approach, a potential peace deal with Iran, a massive media consolidation, and the normalization of sports gambling. The administration is pushing for a non-binding memorandum of understanding, basically a symbolic win to hold up before the president's 80th birthday. If it holds, it might lower energy costs, but if it fails, we're looking at a massive credibility hole. Then there's the media landscape. Reports are circulating regarding a potential massive merger between Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery. Regulators are reportedly signaling a willingness to look past antitrust concerns by pointing at the market share of Netflix and Amazon, which is a hell of a way to justify letting a handful of companies own the entire news and entertainment ecosystem. It effectively integrates news divisions into the administration's political orbit. And if you're wondering where the integrity of sports went, look at the legal battle involving Texas Tech quarterback Brendan Sorsby. He was given a lifetime ban by the NCAA for betting on his own team, only to have a state court judge issue an injunction to let him keep playing. When the revenue models for colleges and media companies are so deeply intertwined with gambling, the line between an honest game and a fixed outcome starts to look pretty blurry. The administration is betting that these deals will look good on paper, but they're leaving the structural foundations of these institutions looking pretty brittle. There is a proxy war happening inside the Democratic Party between the centrist think tank Third Way and Twitch streamer Hassan Piker. The conflict centers on whether the party should be courting moderate voters or doubling down on an aggressive ideological base. Third Way argues that Piker's brand is toxic and alienates the voters needed to flip purple districts. Piker, on the other hand, thinks the establishment is fundamentally inauthentic and out of touch with how people actually consume information. He's betting that the party's traditional moderate-first strategy is a relic that's failing to capture anyone's imagination. Third Way is trying to marginalize him, and Piker is using that marginalization to frame the party leadership as irrelevant. It's a classic catch-22. If the Democrats pivot to the center, they risk losing the energy of their base. If they lean into the confrontational style of the online left, they might scare off the swing district voters who still decide elections. It's a messy, high-stakes standoff, and honestly, neither side seems to have a strategy that can reconcile those two mandates. Until they figure out how to bridge that gap, expect this friction to be the defining feature of the party's internal life heading into the next cycle. Speaking of things that are increasingly harder to control, the AI landscape is shifting under our feet. The US government has officially moved to restrict the use of frontier AI models. Under a new directive, certain high-end frontier models are now off-limits to all foreign nationals, regardless of where they work. The government is framing this as a national security necessity, effectively categorizing advanced AI not as a commercial product, but as a sovereign asset. Here's the fallout. This is an immediate massive headache for any organization that's already baked these models into their infrastructure. If you're a company with non-US employees or international clients, you're now forced to verify citizenship or risk a total system shutdown. It's a classic kill switch scenario that's effectively nuked the idea of a global, frictionless AI supply chain. For the big labs, this is a nightmare. OpenAI and Google are now looking at a regulatory environment where a single reported jailbreak could trigger a government-mandated recall of their own flagship products. You can bet they're going to start prioritizing safety, or at least the appearance of it, over raw performance, just to keep the lights on. Meanwhile, outside the US, you're already seeing procurement officers pushing for domestic or open-weight models. They don't want to be at the mercy of Washington's export controls. We're watching an intellectual iron curtain go up, and honestly, it's making the US look like an increasingly volatile place to do business. Speaking of volatility, if you're tired of the cloud-based rug pull, the move toward local, sovereign AI is gaining real momentum. The logic is pretty straightforward. If you don't own the model, you don't control your own uptime. Developers are shifting toward running models locally on their own hardware. We're talking about using runtimes like Llama or LMStudio to keep data air-gapped and private, which is a massive win for industries like law or healthcare that can't just upload sensitive files to a random cloud server. It's not just about privacy, though. It's about resilience. If the government decides to flip a switch on a major model, a local, always-on stack keeps working. It's essentially the digital version of having a backup generator in your basement. If you're looking into this, the technical consensus seems to be that you don't even need the biggest, most expensive model. Smaller, quantized models, those compressed to run on standard hardware, often outperform the big ones once you give them access to your own tools and file systems. Moving over to the justice system, we've got a brewing conflict between the desire for algorithmic mercy and the basic requirements of the rule of law. Proponents argue that AI can look past the rigid, one-size-fits-all policies of the past to see the person behind the file. They point to research suggesting that when human judges override AI-recommended mercy, recidivism numbers can actually climb. The idea is that an algorithm can factor in medical history or financial pressure to make a decision that's more substantively fair than a human administrator who's just checking boxes. But here's the rub. Critics are pointing out that this creates a system of benevolent management that's completely opaque. A key tenet of justice is that rules should be public, stable, and challengeable. When an AI makes a decision based on a proprietary neural network, you can't exactly cross-examine the math. To make matters worse, there's a mathematical wall here. Research shows that you literally cannot satisfy two different definitions of fairness: predictive parity and equal error rates at the same time if the underlying population has historical inequalities. That means every fair algorithm is actually making a political choice, not a technical one. We're essentially trading verifiable public accountability for a system that's designed to be sympathetic, which feels like a pretty dangerous trade-off. Finally, a quick note on the job market. If you're still hiring based on resumes, you're probably getting played. Because AI can now generate perfect, polished applications, the traditional resume has become a noise-heavy metric. Agency leaders are starting to pivot toward outcome-based hiring. Instead of looking at a CV, they're testing candidates on live problem-solving and deep, idiosyncratic questions that an AI can't easily fake. There's also a big move toward global talent, not just for the cost savings, but because teams that are already fluent in AI-augmented workflows are outcompeting the legacy, local-only shops. The takeaway is pretty clear. The old entry-level path is evaporating. If companies don't start training junior staff to use these tools for high-level judgment rather than just drudgery, they're going to find themselves with a massive leadership vacuum in a few years. It's no longer about who can do the work. It's about who can manage the machine that does the work. That shift in management is hitting every industry, including the track. The Triple Crown is in the rearview, but the thoroughbred industry is currently pivoting toward a summer schedule defined by two major themes: operational efficiency and a shift in how owners treat top-tier talent. First, the Kentucky Horse Racing and Gaming Corporation has officially cut the mandatory veterinary list period for unsoundness from 14 days down to 7. The goal here is simple volume. By shortening the recovery window for minor issues like bruised feet, regulators are aiming to get horses back into starting gates faster. The policy relies on the assumption that state-mandated imaging and blood work will keep equine welfare front and center, even as the administrative clock moves twice as fast. It's a move that feels very much like a play to solve the industry's field size problem. When you can't get enough horses to the gate, you can't sell enough tickets or drive enough handle. And the industry has clearly decided that 14 days of mandatory downtime was a bottleneck they could no longer afford. On the ownership side, we're seeing a deliberate trend toward keeping stars on the track longer instead of rushing them to the breeding shed. The most prominent example is White Abreel. His owners, C2 Racing, have opted to keep the horse in training rather than cashing in on stud fees, betting that the return on investment from high-end prize purses and an expanded racing record will ultimately pay off. It's a long-term play, but it's one that relies heavily on a data-driven approach to management. Trainers like Safi Joseph Jr. are moving away from the old-school localized style of stable management, relying instead on real-time video, support staff, and constant communication to monitor horses across massive, multi-site operations. This isn't just about training anymore, it's about asset management. We're seeing that same data-first philosophy hitting the betting windows too, where they've used player feedback to lower takeout rates on specific bets like doubles and pick threes. The result, according to the industry data, was a higher handle. It turns out that when you actually listen to the people betting the money, treating their feedback as a diagnostic tool rather than an annoyance, you can actually compete with alternative platforms. It's almost like treating the customer with a modicum of respect is good for business. The pressure is mounting on trainers, though. They're being asked to act as industry ambassadors, essentially becoming the face of a sport that is trying to modernize its image while juggling the 24/7 demands of managing elite animals. It's a hell of a balancing act. If the industry wants to grow, it needs these people out front. But if they burn out, the very stables they're running and the horses that drive the whole economy are going to suffer. The industry is betting that if they can synchronize these three things, modernize wagering, longer racing careers for stars, and more efficient health protocols, they can maintain the momentum. Whether that actually holds up when the pressure hits, we'll see. And speaking of pressure, the sports world just saw a massive shift in how championships are won. The New York Knicks are officially champions, closing out their series in 5 games to end a 53-year drought. It wasn't just a win, it was a statistical blowout. But the real story here isn't a singular superstar. The league is shifting toward high-parity, deep-rotation basketball, largely forced by the current collective bargaining agreement that makes those top-heavy, super-team rosters a massive liability. If you're still betting on the old model, chasing perennial MVP candidates, you're basically burning money. The series proved that even generational talents can be neutralized by a disciplined 5-man unit. It's a wake-up call for analysts who keep trying to force a narrative-driven MVP pick when the math clearly favors teams that prioritize system over individual pedigree. Honestly, the superstar era is looking less like the future and more like a relic of a previous CBA. This shift toward live, high-stakes events is happening everywhere, not just in the NBA. Take the UFC's recent event on the White House lawn. It's a pretty clear signal that leagues aren't just selling ticketed entertainment anymore, they're acting as the ultimate hub for corporate and political influence. Investors are pouring money into these live experiences, because in a world where AI and streaming have turned standard media into cheap, oversaturated noise, a live event is the only thing left that still commands a premium price tag. That's why the tension between the NFL and Fox is so heated right now. As the league pushes for more streaming-heavy distribution, traditional broadcasters like Fox are leaning on their DC influence to pull at the threads of antitrust exemptions. It's a classic shakedown. The threat of regulatory scrutiny is the only bargaining chip they have left to stay relevant. If the NFL successfully bypasses these gatekeepers, it's going to set a precedent that will leave traditional media scrambling for a seat at the table. Meanwhile, back at the NBA Finals, the broadcast itself is struggling to find its footing. We saw 23.8 million people tune in for Game 3, which is massive for a non-clinching game. But the production quality is getting weird. ESPN came under fire for filling the broadcast with celebrity reaction shots instead of actually showing the game's tactical breakdowns. It's a shitty trade-off. They're choosing the spectacle of who's sitting courtside over the actual sport, which is a great way to alienate the people who actually care about the game flow. Ultimately, the networks are using high-credibility studio shows to do the heavy lifting because the standard play-by-play teams aren't cutting it. It's a reminder that in this environment, you can't just rely on the name of the league. You need a product that balances competitive stakes, broadcast reach, and actual substance. If you drift too far into celebrity fluff, you lose the trust that makes the audience show up in the first place. That trust issue is exactly what's tearing up the publishing industry. The Future Newsroom study, which surveyed 400 leaders across 86 countries, found a fundamental gap between what news organizations say they value and how they actually operate. While leadership teams point to audience engagement as their top priority, the vast majority are still using legacy production models that prioritize high-volume output over actual reader relationships. Here's the math. Reporters are spending more than 30% of their time on content production. That is work that is increasingly easy to automate, yet it remains the primary focus of the daily grind. This is a massive bottleneck. By forcing journalists to act as content factories, newsrooms are actively undermining the very engagement strategies they claim to be chasing. It gets worse. Only 10% of the newsrooms surveyed have actually bothered to create specialized roles, like engineers or audience engagement strategists, to bridge the gap between commercial data and editorial decisions. That isn't a tech problem. That is a culture problem. It's the stubborn refusal to admit that the old way of doing things is officially dead. The study makes a point that's probably going to sting in some newsrooms. Using editorial independence as a shield to keep journalists away from audience data is actually a net negative. When you hide the data from the people doing the reporting, you aren't protecting their integrity, you're just blinding them. If a journalist doesn't know how their work resonates, or if it resonates at all, they can't possibly adjust to what's relevant. You end up with a disconnect that makes the reporting less valuable, not more. The shift here is supposed to be from chasing reach to cultivating relevance. That is the actual engine of the modern subscription model. If you want people to pay, they need to feel like you're talking to them, not just shouting into the void to hit a traffic quota. Then, of course, there's the AI elephant in the room. The study argues that the definition of a core journalistic skill is changing in real time. Because automation is getting better at the grunt work, the value of a human journalist is shifting. It's moving away from just writing and toward things like computational journalism, open source intelligence. The blunt reality is that newsrooms are facing a choice. They can either keep burning out their staff on high-volume, low-value production, or they can hand that off to AI and let humans do the work that actually requires a human, the deep observation, and original reporting that algorithms can't replicate. Look, I've seen this movie before. It's always the same story. An industry obsessed with how it used to work, terrified to change, and then shocked when the audience stops paying attention. The false choice here is the idea that you have to pick between editorial integrity and audience data. That's a shitty narrative, and it's clearly being used to justify inaction. If you aren't using the data to inform your mission, you're just working harder to be less relevant. And in this market, that's a quick way to go out of business. Anyway, the writing is on the wall. The organizations that fail to adapt are going to be carrying the weight of these legacy workflows while their competitors use AI to clear the decks. It's not about replacing journalists with machines. It's about stopping journalists from acting like machines so they can finally get back to actually being journalists. Which, honestly, sounds like a pretty good deal for everyone involved. This need for efficiency and focus is a lesson that extends well beyond the newsroom. Whether it's the looks-maxing trend, which critics argue prioritizes superficial aesthetics over actual character, or the way athletes like Tony Gonzalez maintain longevity through high-volume intentional repetition, the common thread is the move away from passive consumption toward active mechanical competence. Gonzalez attributes his career success to mental rehearsal and visualization, bridging the gap between intent and execution so that performance becomes a protocol rather than a mood-dependent gamble. It's the same logic that applies to the brain trust model and creative industries. You separate the person from the work to ensure that ego doesn't obstruct the critique. It turns out that when you stop attacking the person, the actual problem becomes a hell of a lot easier to solve. That's the briefing for Sunday. Take the time to look past the optics today. The real story is almost always in the mechanics.